Good afternoon. Want to welcome everyone to the House Judiciary Committee. Appreciate you being here with us this afternoon. We are going to take a few bills out of order to try to accommodate some schedules, so we apologize if in accommodating some we're inconveniencing others. We're going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2174, and I would ask Phil Lemon from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to come forward. Afternoon,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. My name is Phil Lemon. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I'm here to present to you House Bill 2174. After every session of the legislature, the commission goes through all the felony legislation that the legislature passes and incorporates those into the sentencing guidelines system. You've probably all seen this laminated grid. This is the movie version of the sentencing guidelines. What we do after you go home is to incorporate the movie into the book, which are these administrative rules. And so 2174 is our report back to you and requires legislative ratification of those rule amendments to keep these rules in effect. I'm going to keep it at a pretty high level today because I know you have a busy schedule, but we will have all the detail you could ever hope for if you have questions. My testimony goes bill by bill that the legislature passed and that the commission considered in revising the sentencing guidelines rules. I'll just be kind of hitting some high points in there. I've also attached this table that has each bill listed and the rule decisions that the commission made responding to each piece of legislation. And then the last way I tried to help practitioners and you see what we've done is the third attachment, which is the listing of each change within each individual rule. So given that, there are three basic kinds of decisions that the commission makes in reviewing legislation. First, we look at the 26 felonies that the legislature either created or modified in the 2001 session, and we make two decisions on each of those felonies. One is to establish a crime seriousness ranking, and that puts the crime on the grid, which establishes what the presumptive sentence will be. We also decide whether that crime should be classified as a person offense. The significance of designating a crime as a person offense means that a person who has that conviction on their record gets a more severe sentence the next time if they come back and commit a felony. So in other words, if you are convicted of a drug possession felony, everyone who has no record comes as a column I, which means they have no or minimal criminal history. If you have one felony, a non-person felony, that moves you over to H. If that is a person felony, it moves you over to D. And so as you can see, once you get up into the crime category 6, that moves you from a presumptive probation sentence, which means you're going to have a few days in jail and spend time on community supervision, and sends you to the state correctional institutions. So that's the significance of the person crime designation. The other thing that we do is review all the legislation that you pass and respond either to legislative directives, where you direct the commission to take certain rule actions, or just the other enactments that you do that affect the felony sentencing guidelines rules that we need to make sure are incorporated so our rules conform to the statutes. Without dwelling too long, I just want to let you know that we will be asking you to approve some amendments to have drafted and come back and present those to you at work session and go through in a little more detail. So if I'm kind of keeping things at a very high level and rushing through things, just know that we'll be revisiting this again at some point. What I'd like to do is just run through a couple of the decisions that are in this this packet that I think either will be of interest to you or that were resulted in a split vote either at the Sentencing Guidelines Committee, which is a group of practitioners that includes a judge, a district attorney, a defense attorney, a sheriff, community corrections director, board of parole, Department of Corrections, who advise us on these rule changes, or where a split vote occurred at the commission level. And I think that will just help you focus on the areas where there was some disagreement about what the policy should be in these sentencing decisions. The first issue there is in Senate Bill 133, which, and this is on page 4 of my testimony, created a new Class C and a new Class B felony relating to persons unlawfully possessing soft body armor. The C felony basically makes it illegal for any person who has a prior conviction of a felony or misdemeanor involving violence to possess body armor. The disagreement or discussion occurred in the Class B felony, which is when it occurs when a person wears body armor and possesses a deadly weapon while committing or attempting to commit any felony or any misdemeanor involving violence. What we did with that was to subcategorize it, meaning that we split the offense into different pieces, believing that there are different types of conduct covered within that offense. So the offense will be a Category 6 person crime if the unlawful use involved committing or attempting to commit a person felony or misdemeanor involving violence, and would be a Category 4 non-person offense if it involves any other crime. So in other words, if a person wears body armor while committing a robbery or an assault, we believe that that is a more serious level of conduct, obviously, and merits a more severe sentence, and also should be classified as a person crime because it enhances the threat or actual violence against a victim. If a person, for example, wears body armor while they're buying drugs in Old Town, Portland, for example, we don't think that's as severe, and so we reduced that. So that's what the subcategory process does. And there were disagreements on whether the Class B felony should be a person or a non-person crime, and so that's where the split vote occurred. On Senate Bill 423, the legislature created a series of new felonies relating to evading cigarette taxes. The Sentencing Guidelines Committee reduced those from a Category 2 to a Category 1 offense. There's not an awful lot of distinction in terms of the practical outcome there, but it was just a philosophical belief that these were more licensing-type issues rather than some of the other comparative crimes that we looked at. On House Bill 2646, that took the Class A misdemeanor crime of assaulting a public safety officer and elevated that to a felony. The legislature has done that in many occasions over the last several years, and each time we have come back and ranked those consistent with other felony assault threes at a Category 6. We have one member of the committee who has a long-standing disagreement with the practice of taking an assault and elevating it to a felony based on just who is getting assaulted rather than the level of injury or the type of weapon used. And so every time I come back and report to you that we've had a split vote on elevating these felonies because one of our members disagrees with that practice. The final thing I wanted to call to your attention was in House Bill 3035, which created a series of three felonies relating to unlawful administration of a controlled substance. Those were all designated as person crimes by the commission, and we had one member on the Sentencing Guidelines Committee who dissented regarding making those offenses person crimes. There is no real hard and fast rule on what we do and do not call a person crime other than we try to make a judgment on what the level of injury or imminent threat of injury to a victim would be, and so there was a disagreement there. We also go through all the Class A misdemeanors that the legislature has created or modified. The only decision there is whether they should be classified as person misdemeanors or not. And again, the significance is generally the same. Once you have a criminal history that involves those misdemeanors, we count those on a two-for-one basis. So if you have two person misdemeanors in your criminal history, that's the equivalent of having a person felony in your criminal history. So that elevates your sentence. So in summary, that's kind of a real quick run through here. I would like to get the approval of the chair and the committee to get some amendments drafted. We have an appeal in the Court of Appeals that challenges a series of guidelines, rule amendments that were ratified by the Assembly. As you can see in House Bill 2174, these rules are just referenced by their rule number and do not set out the full text of the rule changes for the legislature to consider. There's an active appeal in the Court of Appeals where a defendant says that that violates a provision of the Constitution that requires you to consider and view the full text of any legislative measure, the argument being that they're treating these rules as statutes and believe that those ought to be set out in the bill, where the practice has just been to provide the citation. So to err on the side of caution, we would like to have amendments drafted that do set out the full text so we can resolve that issue and not run the risk of having these overturned for what we think would just be a procedural issue.
And I'll, Mr. Lemon, will authorize you to work with Mr. Taylor to get those amendments prepared for the committee.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Are there questions for Mr. Lemon about the the initial nature of the bill. We'll have an opportunity when this comes back with those amendments in work session to spend some more time specifically talking about how the Criminal Justice Commission operates and how the determinations are made with respect to how bills are ranked. But we've got if you want to entertain a little bit of discussion on that, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question on the last issue about drafting the language rather than citing. Understanding the position, I think that you're advocating, I wonder, do you run some kind of risk of legitimating the case that the plaintiff has got on this by doing this now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, this is where I give my favorite disclaimer in that I'm not an attorney. I've discussed this with this issue with both the chair of the commission, who is Dale Penn, the Marion County District Attorney, and with the appellate attorneys in the Department of Justice. They would much rather, I think, err on the side of caution and make sure that the sentencing guidelines rules are maintained and we don't have them overturned for what we believe it would be a procedural issue. Whether that legitimizes the claim, I think, is a secondary concern and would not, my impression is that would not carry a lot of weight with the court.
You're satisfied? Okay, Representative Jensen.
I suppose have maybe a question for the attorneys on the in the committee as to their impressions on this.
Well, I don't know that erring on the side of caution once an issue has been raised acts in any way, shape, or form as an admission that it was done wrong the first time, and I think the facts of that case as it stands on appeal will be the ones that the court looks at. And a later change in policy about how you go forward with something doesn't necessarily, I think, impact the cases that's on appeal, in my mind. At least I wouldn't view it in that way. And, in fact, I would be troubled if, given the fact that the issue's been raised and gotten to an appellate court level, if something as simple as just putting the full text within the context of the bill wasn't done as a prophylactic measure on the part of the AG's office at their recommendation by the commission. That would be my response. Any of the other so-called attorneys on the committee want to weigh in on that?
So-called? that would be me. No, I guess it's just one of those. If there's been a, irrespective of that, I guess if there's been a deficiency in process in how this has been addressed before, that's no reason to continue once the error has been pointed out, and I guess then we have to deal with whatever the consequences, if there are any, of what has gone through the pipeline already. But I guess that's no justification to perpetrate something if we feel there may have been some insufficient process in the way it's been handled previously. But I agree with Representative Williams. I doubt they don't have much impact.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else want to weigh in? Representative Crummell, you want to talk? You got an opinion? Okay.
No. So I have an opinion, but I won't hear it.
All right. Any other questions then for Mr. Lemon? We're going to excuse him to another meeting, and we'll have an opportunity to talk about all of these changes in more detail when the amendments come back and we're in work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome. We'll close the public hearing now on House Bill 2174. And I think it would be the chair's preference, if we could, to take care of the couple of work sessions that are pending, if we could move through those before we move into the remaining public hearings to ensure that we keep a quorum. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2050, or excuse me, a work session on House Bill 2050. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2050 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. It includes in the definition of child abuse for the purposes of child abuse reporting provisions and endangering the welfare of a minor if a minor is present when methamphetamines or precursor methamphetamines are present. You have the -1 amendments in front of you. On page 2 of the printed bill deletes lines 2 and 3 and insert permitting a person under the age of 18 years to enter or remain in the place where methamphetamines are being manufactured. So it narrows the...
And I think that
those amendments came from, I think, suggestions that Ingrid Swenson made at the meeting.
Right. I think our concern was that it had, and I'm trying to help me if you can take us back, counsel, but there was some concern that the way the original bill was drafted picked up people that we weren't necessarily intending.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, you made a note that one of the questions, what if the cook was a juvenile?
Right.
Himself, he'd make it endanger himself. Be prosecuted for child abusing himself by making the meth.
Right.
Questions.
So it just replaces the current language with permitting a person under the 18 years of age to enter or remain in a place where, so it just is it's more of a more narrow prohibition.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. But it doesn't substantially change the nature of the bill.
Abuse means permitting a child under the age of 18 to enter or remain.
Right. Okay. All right. The chair would then move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2050. Is there any discussion? Any objections? The amendment is adopted. Okay. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly, or Scarry, Crummell.
Go ahead, Shetterly.
No. Crummell's fine.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2050 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell moves House Bill 2050 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, I think I'm about to answer my own question, but it seems to me if the... Well, in the criminal code, I know that if a statute doesn't specify a culpable mental state, it seems to me there's a statute that infers what the culpable mental state is. And I'm just wondering here what the culpable mental state is. Now, we're not in the criminal code. We're in Chapter 419. What's
right.
The culpable mental state... permitting a person under 18 to enter, what level of knowledge, what level of intent is required on the part of the person permitting in order to establish this as an incidence of abuse?
Child abuse. Chairman of the committee, we're talking about the child abuse reporting statute, so you're talking about an adult failing to report. The penalty, if I remember correctly, is a fine.
Why don't we pull out 14B?
Now.
Do you have a question, Representative Anderson?
No.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Shirley.
So these, I'm trying to put these in context. This has been a while since we've...
Yeah, it is.
This is all part of the mandatory reporting statute, and
right.
These are the incidents of abuse that mandatory reporters are required to report.
Mm-hmm. So it means that if a doctor, lawyer, police, firefighter, teacher, or any other mandatory reporter knows that a child is present, as defined by someone under the age of 18, as the amendment sets forth, where methamphetamines or the precursor of methamphetamines are present, that the individual must notify the Department of Human Resources.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
419B010 states any public or private official having reasonable cause to believe that any child with whom the official comes in contact has suffered abuse, or that any person with whom the official comes in contact has abused a child, shall immediately report such reasonable cause to believe. So, for example, if you have reasonable cause to believe that a child abuse would be permitting a child under the age of 18 to enter or remain in a place where methamphetamines is manufactured. So if you had reasonable cause to believe that your neighbor was cooking meth, and you being a lawyer, you'd have to report it.
The distinction is, again, if you look closely at the amendment, the original bill talked about or a precursor of methamphetamine.
Right, right.
And we've narrowed that and simply said where methamphetamines are being manufactured. So we've made it mandatory reporting only where it's manufactured, and that gets you out of the precursor situation, which, as we all know, is so broad that it would be difficult to to identify. So this is clearly a situation where you become aware that there is a manufacturer of methamphetamines, and then you're under the same obligation that you would be under for the other issues that you have on the list.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Well, I appreciate that. That clarifies. So the issue here is that if the mandatory reporter, obviously, is not the one in the context of the bill then who is permitting. It's the mandatory reporter having knowledge of someone else.
That is right.
Permitting. Or reasonable cause, I guess, to believe that someone else is
permitting.
Yeah, that's fine. My only hesitance to even rush down that road is the bugaboo that we tried to deal with last session, and that is the civil liability that attaches for failing to report. Everything we add in terms of an obligation to report raises the specter of expanded civil liability for the dentists and doctors and school teachers and everybody else who police officers who should have reasonable cause to believe but fails to report. That to me is the whole problem with this bill. It comes back to the civil liability.
And your objection isn't particularly to this addition as much as it is to the way the bill functions.
And just that every time we add an incident that constitutes abuse, we're expanding liability on these mandatory reporters.
Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for those members who were not involved in this discussion before, how did we get to civil liability? The answer is that there are several cases in Oregon that is said where you create a statutory duty. The failure to perform that duty results in third-party liability. For example, if you walk out of a police headquarters, police lockup, after you've been stopped and arrested for being drunk, and you walk outside and you walk into the path of a car when you're probably still under the influence, then there's a statute that says you're not supposed to be released until you're basically sober, in so many words. And that failure to do that resulted in third-party liability. So the estate of that individual sued the police department. There's a similar case, and I think it went against the Department of Human Resources, similarly. A statutory duty, someone gets hurt, third-party sues. The issue here is that in the past there have been incidences where someone failed to report child abuse. These facts that were brought before this committee were someone went to a law firm and said, I want a divorce. My husband's having an affair with an underage person. Well, she was wrong, having an affair with two of them. For some reason, it got outside the attorney-client privilege. The victim of the abuse then sued the law firm. It was settled out of court. So this is the issue that we're talking about third-party liability that arises and where there's a duty created to report.
And we've several times in the legislature attempted to try to narrow the liability issue through various approaches and have never been successful because of the overwhelming obligation it creates. I guess I go back, though, to the position on this particular amendment that given what we know in this committee based on our experience over the last several years about the impact of methamphetamine and its presence and its impact on children who are subject to being exposed to the various processes through its creation. If there's a list of something we're going to be mandatorily obligated to report on, in my mind, with the pervasiveness of that activity, this is one of those things. It ought to be on the list. And if we're going to have a list, this one ought to be there, and that's the reason that I'm willing to support the additional exposure of liability, because I would want people to know that, you know, if that's the issue you got going on, you better report on it.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Do you have a question, Representative? No. And that's fine. I mean, like I said, I wish we could revisit the whole issue of civil liability because that certainly makes it more difficult to expand each of these when liability attaches to each one. But I think it's just important for the members, especially that weren't here to enjoy this debate last session, to know that this the liability, the obligation to report is 24 hours a day. It's not just information that you acquire in the course of the performance of your professional duties or your police duties or that the school teacher learns in the context of a school day. So if you have if you are a mandatory reporter, I guess under this expansion, let's say, with a teenage son who reports that some of his friends went over to a place where methamphetamine was being manufactured, then I guess under that statute, if you believe your son to be a credible source, you've got an obligation to report the parents of those children who your son reported to you went to this place. I mean, and if you don't, and something happens as a consequence of that, you are potentially civilly liable, because I would say that probably constitutes reasonable cause to believe.
Yeah,
that's a pretty high burden on the mandatory reporters.
I agree, and I think that's why you pick up the phone and you dial, the bar's office, and you get some additional assistance on whether or not what you have just experienced qualifies you as a mandatory reporter obligation.
Well, and if I can just do, if we can move this thing, but I'll bet that some professional groups that represent the mandatory reporters are doing better than others in terms of educating their members as to their liability, and that's the other concern I have as to just how many of these mandatory reporters realize the extent of their reporting obligation, that 24-hour nature of the obligation and the civil liability that attaches to failure to do it. But
right.
I guess that's their risk.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this, in my mind, touches on the same issue we have with terrorism, where we really are faced with a major problem that whether I'm a dentist or an attorney or a father or whatever, I think we need to be more attuned to what's going on around us. And I certainly don't want to get into a Russian state of surveillance, but I do think that we need to be maybe a little more trigger happy than we are in making the authorities of aware of what's going on. That doesn't mean that they're convicted, but it does mean that they at least have a chance to investigate and see if there is in this home that we've alerted them to some illegal, illicit activity going on. And I think that we need to be more, I think the authorities need more of the help of the whole community. I think that's what I'm hearing Chair Williams say.
Representative Ackerman,
yes,
Representative McPherson.
Briefly, I think the liability issue is going to come back and revisit us a number of times, and maybe this is a subject for our interim work.
I'm willing to put it on the list, Bob. I've gone down that road a number of times. The moment you move down that road, you have everybody accusing you of wanting to be soft on child abuse and that we're trying to shirk our responsibilities. But I'm, I think it presents what I worry about is it causes people actually to not report and to close their eyes mm-hmm. to things as opposed to report, because their fear is you get pulled into this thing one way or the other and you're going to get stuck. So I'd be happy to put it on an interim discussion list as we're building that list for the interim. I saw Representative McPherson's hand as well.
I was just going to express concern about the same issue that Representative Shetterly has raised. I think the issue, as the chair has correctly pointed out, is not whether this ought to be on the list. And when I look at the existing list and I see definition that includes subjecting a child to a substantial risk of harm to the child's health or welfare, I mean we've got a pretty expansive category in there already, and so I think that failing to add presence in a place where methamphetamines are being manufactured probably doesn't make sense to fail to add it, because it would just really add something more specific to a general standard that's already in the statute. But I think that some attention to this concern, particularly in view of some of the people who are in this list of public or private official, and I'm assuming the way the statute works, although I haven't looked it up, is that those are the people who are subject to reporting.
That's right.
And it includes school employee. So, and it doesn't mean necessarily even a teacher in the classroom. It means the person who's the school secretary down at the school, the office, who maybe, kids are coming into school, maybe you're with illness excuses or something like that. They might come in into possession of this information even in their workday, let alone in their activities outside of the workday. And I would hazard the guess that our school secretaries are not trained in their child abuse reporting obligations.
You might be surprised. I mean, I think the people who fall under the statute, to varying degrees, granted, but I think they do a pretty good job of trying to remind everybody who is a mandatory reporter. I know certainly the bar, we're under an obligation. I think, is it an hour a year, I think?
Because we're required to undergo training, and there are categories in which you have to go to a certified program.
Right, but I think that there are some school districts, I'm sure, who do an education opportunity for their employees to remind them of their obligations. But I agree, it does create cuts a very broad swath of responsibility. That certainly a lot of people, I mean, I will tell you that I don't walk through the Safeway on my given day sort of looking for these opportunities, and yet if you see somebody doing something in the Safeway, you're under our obligation to report it. It puts people in a tough spot. Questions?
No, just Mr. Chair, just one. I can't resist one more. I know
you could.
In the last year, no, I can't. I have seen a child not properly belted in a moving car. I mean, I know I have. I can't remember an incident, but you know it happens.
Subsection G. Subsection G. Okay, the motion. Oh, Representative Jensen, I apologize.
That's fine. Seems to me that we've visited something similar to this before in previous sessions of the legislature. And I've always been struck when I look at this statute why legislators are not included in the mandatory reporting. And that's not a flippant comment.
No, it's a fascinating concept.
Because in our functioning, we have a lot of constituent work where we may come in contact and may have reasonable belief to, you know, that a child is being subjected to abuse.
Well, Representative Jensen, I heard Representative Shetterly comment that, you know, during campaigns you spend a lot of time going door to door. I mean, there's a opportunity to come in contact with a lot of people.
Yes.
You know what, Representative? I'm not interested in amending this bill right now to do that, but if you want to prepare an amendment and put it forward to the Senate when this bill gets over there, I might come over and actually... So maybe the only way to get the legislature to have the broader discussion we're talking about their reporting obligation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, you bet. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Quick question. Is there a reverse of the obligation? In other words, if you were to report that somebody was abusing your child by some means that's on the list, and it turned out that it was not true, could that person then sue you for causing them harm for allegations that were unfounded?
I think the answer, Representative Crummell, is anybody can sue anybody for anything. Whether they could sue you successfully, I think the answer would be likely not. I think there are some immunity protections based on good faith. If it was done not in good faith, then the answer is yes, you could be sued. If it was a good faith based on a reasonable belief, you would be protected from that suit. Doesn't mean you wouldn't get sued.
Oh yeah,
but you'd be protected from, I think, being.
Well, you still have to go through the cost of defending yourself, but you probably would be exonerated in the end.
It's 419B.025, immunity of a person making a report in good faith.
Okay,
the motion is to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? All right, hearing none.
Did we move the bill, the amendment?
I think we moved the amendment, okay. And then I moved the bill.
That's right.
Is that right, Ann?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we're ready to call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Pearson?
Aye.
Representative Pazeski?
Excused.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2050 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm not going to sign it to Representative Shetterly because the floor discussion would go on way too long. Does anybody want to take this? You want to do it, Representative Barker? All right.
Your chair.
Okay. We're going to now move to a quick work session on House Bill 2086. I say quick. I thought the last one was going to be quick. But it was a very good discussion to acquaint, I think, the members of the committee with that mandatory reporting statute. So, counsel?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2086 creates a crime of cockfighting, classifies it a Class C felony, stipulates the person commits a crime if the person knowingly owns, possesses, keeps, breeds, trains, buys, sells, or advertises to sell a fighting bird, promotes, or participates in cockfights, keeps, manages, accepts payment or admissions to place where cockfighting goes on, manufactures, buys, sells, barters, exchanges, possesses, or advertises to sell a gaff or a slasher.
Okay, we're all...
We have a dash one amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that address some of the concerns that were raised in our last hearing. By, among others, Representative Shetterly, going over to page 2, on line 16, it would change the language from intends to offers to sell equipment with the intent that the equipment be used when training or handling a fighting bird. And then over in page 6, clarifies that animal means a bird, a reptile, amphibian, fish, or non-human other than a dog. After dog, insert a fighting bird as defined in section 1 of this 2003 Act. So that excludes these from the provisions currently in the law about fighting animals because they both have their individual specific, or will have their individual specific statutes.
Right.
So we also have an opinion letter from Legislative Counsel's Office concerning the intent here, written by Charles Daniel Taylor, no relation, and about certain questions that were raised concerning intent that the raised at the last meeting.
So the dash one amendments then address the issue that was raised by Representative Shetterly, and then it also addresses the issue that by adding the or fighting bird as defined by section 1 of the Act deals with the distinction where they would be excluded from the other fighting animal provisions of the bill. And then you've got the letter that I requested from Legislative Council. This letter was based on issues that were raised in the hearing about the possibility of sort of upstream people involved somehow in the process of poultry or fowl issues being somehow caught up in the nature of this bill. I think if you give this letter a read, what you'll see is that there is a substantial number of protections within the bill that a person would have to have either in, you know, either knowingly or with intent be in a position to be prosecuted under the bill. I'll point you to the section, one of the third of the last paragraph in Mr. Taylor's letter from Legislative Council. In the case of a seller, it would be necessary to show that the purchaser intended for the bird to be used in cockfighting and that the seller knew of and thereby shared that intention. Merely selling a bird without knowing that the purchaser was intending for the bird to be used in cockfighting could not sustain a conviction. Similarly, in an earlier discussion, he talks about, for example, a person who simply sells bird feed to a customer without any awareness that the feed is being supplied to fighting birds lacks the awareness required to sustain a conviction. So I think this letter addresses the issues of the mental state and I think puts to rest some of the issues that were raised at the hearing about people who are raising birds not for any illegal intention being caught up in the web of the statute. And then finally, there's been some materials distributed by Ms. Peterson also relative to a new California statute and issues involving the exotic Newcastle disease outbreak in California, which apparently, based on the article, were traced back to actual cockfighting operations. So those are the issues. We have the dash one amendments in front of us, and we're in work session. So the
chair,
Representative Shetterly.
I want to move the dash ones. I appreciate the amendments, and they appear to be... to satisfy the concerns I had or the issues I raised about the bill, I'm ready to go.
Okay. Representative Shirley's moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2086. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shirley.
I'll move House Bill 2086 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Shirley moves House Bill 2086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
I just want to put on record, one of the witnesses in the hearing here last month caught me at my office just on my way down here and said that they had some other amendments they wanted to get into the bill, and I something that I'm sure he could try and find them in the Senate. So I understood the bill was ready to move today. So I wanted to just put on the record that there's apparently some other consideration for amendments on this.
I'm sure there is. All right. Thank you.
They're not mine.
Okay. With that, Ann, we'll go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
No.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2086 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'll carry it.
Same speech?
Yeah. Same speech. Okay. And now we're going to go to House Bill, thank you, committee, to House Bill 2101, open a public hearing.
Mr. Fussner from the Department of Justice.
Mr. Fussner and David Niebel are the two witnesses signed up, if you'd come forward.
Where did you say we were going, Mr. Chair?
House Bill 2101.
Thank you.
Mr. Fussner, you're up first on the witness list. Do you want to go first?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm the attorney in charge of criminal appeals in the Oregon Department of Justice. I think I can explain what House Bill 2101 is intended to do in just a few sentences. We have circuit courts that issue Abuse Prevention Act restraining orders. Generally, this is a domestic couple where one of the partners is abusing the other one. She gets a court to enter a protective order that keeps the abuser away from her. Let's say this happens in Malheur County. Well, if the parties continue living there and the restrained person violates the restraining order, it's enforced by bringing a contempt of court action to punish that violation. And that contempt of court action presumably would be brought in Malheur County where the order was issued. The problem arises that this bill is intended to fix when the parties leave Malheur County and move to Multnomah County. And it may even be that the protected party leaves the county deliberately to get away from the abuser. So now she's living, let's say, in Multnomah County. The restrained person violates the order by attempting to contact her there. The police are called. And the question is, can a contempt of court proceeding be brought in Multnomah County, the county where the violation occurred, or does everybody have to go back to Malheur County? We had a case, Bachman versus Bachman, decided by the Court of Appeals recently, that's in my written testimony. And in that case, the court held, yes, you can do the contempt proceeding in the county that originally issued the protective order. It did not decide whether you can bring a contempt proceeding in the county where a violation took place, and that remains an open question on which the Oregon statutes are silent. House Bill 2101 would simply make it clear that a contempt of court proceeding may be brought in either county. It's essentially for the convenience of the witnesses, the victim, the investigating police officers. It's designed not only for convenience but to save perhaps a little money, because instead of having to transport a prisoner who's awaiting trial on one of these contempts to a different county, you can handle the whole proceeding quickly and more efficiently in the county where the violation occurred. I have nothing to add beyond that other than what's in my written testimony, but I would, of course, be happy to answer any questions anyone might have.
Thank you, Mr. Fussner. Why don't we go ahead and let Mr. Niebel give his testimony, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Alliance to End Violence Against Women, which is a statewide grassroots organization that advocates for domestic and sexual violence victims. I'm here to support House Bill 2101. This is a problem that was brought to our attention in a number of different meetings we had around the state when we were developing our legislative agenda. I believe that House Bill 2101 takes care of the problem in a way that's acceptable to district attorneys and is good for petitioners under the Abuse Prevention Act. I have distributed some testimony that was sent to me by Laura Bruce, who is a resident of Coos County, who, and it's sort of an illustration of the problem. She got a restraining order in Linn County, moved to Coos County for her own safety. The order was violated in Coos County. She couldn't get Linn County to bring contempt charges, and so there the case sits. I believe that this would give the Coos County District Attorney the opportunity to bring contempt charges in a case like that, which I think is entirely appropriate. So on behalf of the Alliance to End Violence Against Women, I heartily support House Bill 2101.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for either Mr. Fussner or Mr. Niebel? I have one, and I think that it shouldn't... I hope your answer is going to be that it wouldn't matter. We're simply allowing them to go into a different court in order to file, so there shouldn't be any costs associated, any additional costs associated with the court. It's just shifting, essentially, the operations from one county jurisdiction to the other. But nothing else procedurally would add any additional cost to the court. Am I right about that?
Chair Williams, I think that's correct.
Okay.
And you, Mr. Chair, I would agree.
You would agree. Okay. That was the one question I had, and it seemed like it wouldn't, but I wanted to put that on the record in case at some point somebody from the court wanted to suggest otherwise. Is there any other questions for the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a technical question. Does the court that issued the order... does it lose jurisdiction to issue contempt proceedings or sanctions once the victim who's being protected moves out of the county, or is it just a sort of disinterest on their case because on their part because they don't have have the victim close at hand?
Well,
in either one,
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I do not believe they lose jurisdiction. I think they still have jurisdiction, and under this bill, they would still have venue. I think what it comes down to is a decision on the part between the two district attorneys and the two counties that would be involved about which county is going to go forward with contempt proceedings.
They would both have the authority to do so. It's just a question of then working between the two of them as to who would handle the proceeding.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I believe that's the case.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I agree with that. I think that's correct. It could be brought in either county, and I don't anticipate that there'd be any difficulty in working that out. It's largely going to be a decision made based on the convenience of the parties and where the witnesses are, and the district attorneys do that kind of thing fairly routinely in other kinds of cases. I don't anticipate any trouble having that happen.
All right. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krimmel.
Does phone contact usually constitute violation of a restraining order?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krimmel, I think I can answer that by saying that the Abuse Prevention Act statutes, as I recall them, permit a court to enter a protective order that can include no contact and would include no telephone contact, not writing letters, not contacting a person by means of a third party, not coming within a certain distance of the person's residence or school or place of work, but I believe it's up to the issuing judge as to how far to go in entering that order. And some people may not want the order to be that broad, and they may only ask for, don't harass me at work anymore. Others may want complete no contact. Perhaps you can elaborate on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I agree with Mr. Fussner. I think that's right. It's for the court to fashion the relief in light of what the petitioner has alleged and what the petitioner has requested and what the court thinks reasonable under the circumstances. But yes, I agree that is a no contact order. Comprehensive no contact order is often part of the relief that's granted in an abuse prevention proceeding.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
So if an order is written, let's say it's written in Multnomah County, the person that's not being restrained, but the plaintiff, I guess, in that case, moves to Grant County, and the person to which the restraining order is against stays in Multnomah County but makes a phone call to the person in Grant County. Does it make a difference as far as, does that constitute that it occurred in Grant County so the person could file, the person that's harmed could file it in Grant County, or would the person have to go back to Multnomah County in that case because the person that the restraining order was ordered against is still sitting in Multnomah County? I guess the question is, which county did the violation occur in?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. Off the top of my head, I would think that either county probably could handle a contempt for that violation because you have the restrained party violating it by making the phone call in Multnomah County, and then you have the harm occurring in Grant County. I can't recall offhand of a case like that I have ever seen come up.
Mr. Fusters, what if they were on their cell phone and they were in between the two counties?
In between?
I know it may sound but the problem is that you know, does the person that wants to try to enforce a restraining order then, are they forced to go back to Multnomah County, or can they file it in the county in which they're now residing in? Because, you know, may make a difference as to whether or not they even determine to or decide to try to enforce it.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think as Mr. Fussner said, the violation could be deemed to have happened in either place, because after all, the contact when, let's say, she picks up the phone in Canyon City is that's the violation. It's when she is contacted by him and she is in Grant County. And I think if the Grant County District Attorney were willing under this statute, under this bill, to file a contempt proceeding in Grant County, that would be appropriate.
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, if I could just add one thought to that. I think that the intent of this bill is largely to give more flexibility to the system so that in situations like the one you described, where it may not be absolutely clear where you would bring them, the court system and the prosecutors will have the opportunity to choose the one that makes the most sense. Whereas now, at least arguably, these cases all have to go back to the county of issuance, even though it's virtually disconnected now from where the violation took place.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2101. Before I do that, is there anyone else here who had intended to testify on House Bill 2101? Okay, not hearing no one, then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2101. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2101. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I move we move this to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves we move House Bill 2101 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, and call the roll.
Representative
Barker? Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2101 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Anderson, I'll sign you to carry it, if you would. That takes us to House Bill 2082. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2082, and we will call up Francis, are you here? You signed up in favor, is that right? You checked the four box. Did you mean to check the against box or the neutral box?
For it, but with some amendments.
Okay. All right. I'm trying to figure out who to start with on this. Why don't we just bring up the panel? How about Bob Jundiff, Bob Nickel, Kelly Skye, and then we'll bring up and Dave Rugg. Are you guys all fine coming up together? I know you don't all work together or represent the same people, but
we like each other.
It'll give a nice little dialogue. Pull up an extra chair there. And then I'm going to bring up Phil and Francis after that. Is that all right? Is that all right with you, Phil?
That's fine.
Okay. Yes, why don't you explain it for us, counsel, and then we'll have the panel start.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. That's okay. House Bill 2082 comes to you from the Interim Judiciary Committee at the request of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. It relates to civil commitments and relates to the investigation prior to those of allegedly mentally ill people and the use of the law enforcement data system, which is also known as LEDS. This bill would allow the investigator in investigating an incident where there may be a hearing to determine whether someone is whether there's probable cause to believe that someone is dangerous to themselves or to others and is in need of immediate care, which is the standard for civil commitment. That person that's investigating would not only have access to the homes of the person and people that would have pertinent information, but would also have access to the system that LEDS that does record arrests or convictions in an investigation report. And then in Section 2 of the bill on page 3, line 6, would allow that those findings in the LEDS system could be used in making a probable cause determination. And this bill would be applicable to investigations initiated on or after the date of the act.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Why don't we just take in the order that you signed up? Is that all right? So we'll start with Bob. You were the first one to sign up. Everyone always signs up and leaves that top line blank because they think someone else will sign up on the top line and then they won't have to go first. So
caught again. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundiff. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I think I went down on the second line because we're in opposition, so we'll just lead off with that. This particular, the content of this bill actually was in two bills from last session, and those bills came out of a interim work group that was conducted under the authority of the Judiciary Committee. Like most things in mental health, those two bills were subject to a lot of contention, and there was not consensus within those groups as to whether the two particular bills should be enacted or not. Mental health in general, oftentimes in the advocate world, the provider world, it does lead to contention. And what I'd like to do, try to cut quickly to the point, is why this particular bill also has some contention attached to it. Oddly enough, what this bill has to do with the civil commitment process, which is the gateway to hospitalization, involuntary hospitalization in some sort of a facility. Given the lifeboat nature of our mental health system as it existed 2 years ago and as, of course, it more acutely exists today, these are very precious resources. However, they're resources that everyone isn't excited to get. And so in certain cases, you'll have people who are being civilly committed is really their only way to receive mental health services that they may want. For other people, it's a unwanted intrusion into their lives. What House Bill 2082 will do is it will make a person's criminal law past, both in terms of arrests and convictions, will make that past a determining factor in whether a person is either one of the lucky ones, in other words, the lucky in that they want to get in for those services and they have no other way to get them, or an unlucky one, someone who's being held against their will in a mental institution when they don't want to be and don't feel it's appropriate. In other words, if you take two individuals with the exact same mental health needs, it would be logical to assume that the person with a record of arrests or a record of convictions will be the person who goes through the commitment process. The other person is the person who would not. The underlying problem that we have, and when I say we, our organization stays in close touch with people who are consumers of mental health services, and in many ways we speak for people who are consumers of those services and have voiced opinions to us about this bill. Their concern is that the mental health system will increasingly become a system that is really tied very closely to the criminal system, and that that the mental health system will be used as a way to, in a sense, enforce criminal sanctions against people who have mental health disabilities. That those folks will be disfavored in the system, and that the prejudice that exists against folks who have severe mental disorders and its association with criminal behavior will only be strengthened by this process of taking criminal pasts into account. The other concern, really, besides that, is who will be making those determinations. For those of you who aren't familiar with our civil commitment laws, this bill touches upon two aspects of the commitment law. In the commitment law, there's an initial point at which a person enters into consideration for commitment, and that's when a mental health professional makes a decision as to whether to hold a person temporarily so that their situation can be investigated, and that investigative information can then be forwarded to a court. What this bill does is it allows that the person who makes that initial determination as to whether someone is held involuntarily for up to 5 working days, it allows that person to have access to LEDS information, and it also allows the subsequent investigator, who's another mental health professional, to have access to that same material. And so essentially what you have is two mental health professionals making assessments about whether certain criminal arrests or violations are relevant to a person's mental health needs. The bare information contained in those records will be whether there was an arrest or a conviction. It will not say whether that arrest or that conviction was related to a mental health episode for that person or whether the person had any mental health problems at the time of that arrest or conviction. It will just be a raw piece of information. What we would contend is that mental health professionals are not trained to and should not be put in the position of evaluating or making the impossible task, we would contend, of deciding that a criminal arrest or criminal conviction is somehow related to a person's mental health condition and their need for hospital-level care. I think that's basically what I have to offer.
Okay. I think we'll go ahead and just have the panel talk, and then we'll do questions. Bob, you want to go next?
Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm a manager of community services for the Department of Human Services Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Rather than read through the written testimony, I think I'd just like to talk more generally about some of the pros and cons of the bill. I'm here to testify in opposition to it, but there are parts of this that I think the department could support. The concern that we have about the distinction between prior arrest and prior conviction
records is an important one here. I think we could get comfortable with the idea of access to information about convictions, but not about arrests. And I think the reason is probably obvious in that arrests have not been adjudicated to the point where there's actually a crime that's been considered to be committed. There is enough research literature that points to the value of looking at past acts of violence as being a predictor of future acts, and that's the reason why convictions might be, in our opinion, of some help. But we do have a problem, and it's probably the primary reason for us being in opposition to the bill of including arrests in that information. I think the second thing that I'd like to just speak to is the issue of cost. And right now, we've just been in a position of removing all of the crisis dollars, and it's this portion of money that funds the investigators themselves, and it would be that portion of money that would have to be tapped in to pay for connecting to and maintaining access to lead. So I think that's another consideration that the committee might want to take a look at.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Hi, Kelly.
Hi there. Kelly Sky. I'm the legislative representative with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Chair Williams, members of the committee. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association opposes this bill. We have many of the same concerns that have been voiced already, but I want to add a couple. And we are primarily concerned with the information of arrests. We deal with LEADS and the information that's contained in the law enforcement data system quite a bit, and that information, with the exception of those convictions that are admissible under the evidence code, which are a very restrictive few, that information that's available in LEADS is not admissible in court. And that is because it has very little value. As Mr. Nichols stated, the existence of arrests does not provide very much information. However, it can be extremely inflammatory. That's why this information would never be admissible in court under the Oregon evidence code. Because someone has a certain arrest on their record does not indicate even that they had arrested the correct person. It certainly doesn't indicate any link to a mental illness. It doesn't indicate why the case was subsequently dismissed or actually never issued. So that information, the inflammatory nature of the information regarding arrests, clearly outweighs any value that it has in the civil commitment process. The second concern that we have is that the fiscal analysis does not reflect the defense function. In my other job, I'm an attorney at the Public Defender's Office, which has the contract in Multnomah County to defend all the civil commitment proceedings, with the exception of those that we have conflicts of interest in. And I've covered a number of those hearings. We receive the investigator's report 24 hours before the hearing. We meet our client, and we proceed with the hearing. We are required to provide a constitutionally adequate representation in these cases, and what that includes is investigating claims that that are made. If we are provided with a LEADS report, and that LEADS report is going to be relied upon in making decisions, we are going to be necessarily required to investigate those arrests that our clients tell us don't have value in the process, that are inflammatory. And the first thing that we would need to do is to get copies of the police reports from those arrests, which we can do, but we cannot do it in 24 hours. This is going to lead to numerous setovers of hearings. Those hearings are purposely set within the immediate hold time, but under the statute, our clients have the option of setting over those hearings. And many of these people, even if not committable, do suffer from mental illnesses. And if they see that prior arrests for which they were not convicted, are going to be used against them, they're going to want us to investigate. In order to get copies of the police reports, we use the subpoena process, but we also have to pay for them, and those funds come out of indigent defense dollars, which you're all well aware are few. In Multnomah County, we pay $10 for every police report plus a certain amount, and I can't recall whether it's 25 cents or 50 cents a page over and above, I think it's five pages for every police report. So with someone who has a significant criminal history, that's going to be a significant bill to get those police reports. So you can imagine that the fiscal analysis does not reflect all the costs, and we actually think that it would be a significant increase in costs. The cases that are set over for hearings, those people are actually held that much longer on their hold, and the attorneys are working that much more on those cases. We have assistants who do the investigation on those cases, and all of that work is going to increase. So it's for those reasons that we oppose the bill.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. Dave.
Hi, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Rugg, and I'm a legal assistant with the Public Defender's Office. And I, the last couple of years, have been assigned to do the civil commitment proceedings for our office. Essentially, my job is to meet the clients the day before the hearing, after I've received these reports, go talk to the client, explain the process to them, report back to the attorney, and so the attorneys generally are in court, so I'm just kind of the first person that they're going to be seeing. Again, many of the concerns that have already been expressed here, I have as well. I think that it's very prejudicial to have the information in front of the judge that that's so vague. I don't know how many folks here have actually seen what a ledge report looks like, but it's not straightforward at all, and there's very little information on there. One of the things that hasn't been brought up is that these ledge reports are going to be attached to the, my understanding from the bill, attached to the investigation report. That report goes to the client and will be served on the client. So they're going to get a copy of this ledge report as well, and they're going to be seeing that. One of the biggest problems that I have with folks when I go to see them has to do with this issue that we're talking about right now, is people tend to be, they tend to focus on things that don't have a lot to do with really what the issues are at the civil commitment proceeding, because they're not thinking straight at the time that this is going on. When you're adding more information that's in basically in hieroglyphics, if you've ever seen one of these reports, trying to explain to somebody what all this stuff means is not only going to take me more time, but it's going to be impossible in a lot of situations. It's just going to add more confusion to people that are already confused about what's going on. One of the first questions I almost always get asked when I first see a person is, you know, what are the charges? And, you know, I have to spend the first 5 or 10 minutes trying to explain that this is not a criminal prosecution, that this is a civil proceeding. What we're trying to do here is, you know, see if you need some help. You know, this is not the police that are coming after you. And you got to understand, too, that my experience is that what you're going to see in these ledge reports is that the folks that I deal with have contact with the police. They have lots of contact with the police in general. The police are the folks that are going to take them to the hospitals. If they're going to a civil commitment hearing, they've been brought there by the police 90% of the time. Not all the time. There are other ways that they get there, but most of the time that's what happens. They have a fear of the police a lot of times, and what I've noticed in a number of cases is that people tend not to be aggressive with anyone else, and they tend to get aggressive when the police show up. And I think that again, it's prejudicial in that you don't see what the circumstances are from that ledge report. The other thing that I also am very concerned about is nobody's really talked about the fact that it also, on these ledge reports, it shows that there are, if you're a victim of a crime, it will show that on that report as well. And one of the things is that the judge is going to be looking at, not only is, you know, is he a danger to others, but if you look at, you know, somebody's been a victim a number of times, which happens frequently because our clients are mentally ill and they're taken advantage of, and a judge can use that to make a determination that they're a danger to themselves because they can't stay out of harm's way. And again, that's with very little information, and I think that the prejudicial impact of that far outweighs, you know, any good that's going to come out of that process.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. I guess I want to, I'm sure we'll all have some questions for you. I want to just ask, I heard you, Bob, indicate that while you don't like the arrest side of it, you'd be more interested
assuming money being no object for the bill, that you'd be more interested in at least the conviction side. I get the sense I'm just in your agreeing with me, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And then, Bob, I heard you say that you'd be opposed to either conviction or arrest information being provided, right?
That's correct.
And, Kelly, you guys would rather no information be provided, but you think conviction is better than arrest?
Correct.
Okay. All right. I wanted to make sure that I sort of we got the sliding scale here. I think the general discussion that we've had about this bill before as it moved through in a previous generation was the discussion about the, and I know, and we're going to have to all suspend reality for just a minute and pretend like we're not in the midst of the worst fiscal crisis the state has had in, you know, I don't know, maybe ever, and talk about when we did have crisis centers and people to deal with this issue. The idea was to give them the best available information that they could get in trying to triage in some sort of way the people who were the most dangerous to themselves and others in a reasonable fashion. So the debate has been whether or not arrests and an arrest record or a conviction is in any way, shape, or form a relevant correlating sort of document to someone making that decision. I don't think any of us on the committee are mental health professionals. But I think the issue is from just a basic rational judgment standpoint. One would think that all the information you could have about an individual in trying to make that kind of a triaging decision would be of assistance. The reason people don't like prejudicial information, Mr. Rugg, is because it usually is indicative of something. That's why it's prejudicial. And I think the sense that this information is available and could assist someone in that triaging environment was the general perception about this. Now, whether or not it's unfair to use arrests which don't result in conviction versus convictions as a way to sift through those prejudice issues to get to something that actually stuck is, I think, a different discussion one that I understand. But I think that's in my mind where this issue has sort of always revolved. I understand that these people are not criminal and have not, in the context of a civil commitment situation, committed a criminal act. But at the same time, there is a large crossover, Mr. Chinda, as you well know, between the justice system and the mental health system. And we're trying, frankly, and have tried in this committee, to help us figure out how to not make that so impactful. But the reality is that in those triaging situations, we do want a system that takes the person who's likely to go out and do something to themselves or to somebody else and to use the system to get them as quickly as we can into some sort of treatment with the best rational data that we've got available. And that's where I think I struggle a little bit with the positions that, to some varying degree, that all of you take on the bill. So that's my, not again, irrespective of the money. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that all of you can sit back and be happy about is we don't have any money to do this anyway. So we could fire it off the Ways and Means tomorrow, and we could all use it for wallpaper once the session gets out, I suspect. But with that, I'm going to let my other committee members have crack at you, unless you have a response you want to comment on my comments, because this is the issue that I've been struggling with on this issue since it's been under discussion for about the last 3 years, it seems to me. You want to take a shot, Bob?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. There's a lot of focus on the folks who have a criminal record. Most mentally ill people do not have a criminal record, and so it's also possible that looking at criminal arrest or criminal conviction information would also lead us to believe that someone is not as much of a risk. So I think we tend to focus on one side of it, but I think the other side of the equation could be considered too.
Okay, that's a fair comment. I appreciate it. Bob?
Maybe I can make it unfair. Sure. Mr. Chair.
That's why I have the gavel. I get to rule on that.
One of the things about civil commitment, of course, is that process is supposed to focus on a person's immediate behavior and immediate clinical needs and immediate dangerousness. And that is why in the process, certainly in the investigation, it isn't completely wide open and going back infinitely in terms of what's happened in the past. If a person is engaged in dangerous behavior, which brings them into the commitment process, all of that information comes into the process, and it gets considered at that time. I understand that this, your sense that the more information, the better. The question then becomes just, when does the information go over the borderline from being more useful information to being more prejudicial information? And we would suggest that in this case, it does go over that line. Plus, that information can be brought to the court in the judicial process, and that is still open. But what we're doing is that we're shifting these decisions and evaluations to mental health professionals who are making fairly quick decisions and evaluations. And I think there's just a lot of room for mischief when you do that.
And I understand that, Bob, but I mean, we're also sometimes asking these mental health professionals, given limited resources, to decide, you know, with very little time as to whether or not someone is going to be potentially detained based on their ability to evaluate whether they're going to be harmful to themselves or others. And again, it's a job that I never aspire to and one that I would never want, but if I ever had it, I think I would want the most accurate and available information about this person, and if what brought them to us was behavior that wasn't necessarily violent or assaultive, but in reviewing that arrest report, I had seen that the individual had been convicted of some sort of behavior that was in fact violent, and that showed up on the LEDS report. And I got three people, and I got one available bed. It might prejudice me, given the totality of the circumstances, to decide that that is the person that I feel like, given my resources, is the one I'm most interested in trying to keep detained for fear of what they might do to themselves or somebody else. I guess, you know, again, I'm not a mental health professional, so I'm applying probably a whole set of different standards to making this evaluation that aren't appropriate. But for better or worse, that's the way I would evaluate the situation. And, you know, I could be persuaded on the arrest side, I think. But even then, I'd be interested in, you know, I'd still want that information if I was the person on the spot having to do the triage. Mr. Rowe.
Comment, Mr. Chair. I agree with some of what you're saying, but I also think that there's a danger there that some of the good investigators, I agree, you know, I don't think it's going to be a big problem with. But I think that there's also going to be a tendency there to, you know, with the investigators that are not as hardworking and to use that information as a way this is what I can toss on the pile and not really investigate it. And essentially, it's, you know, they can say, I don't know what the judge decides because he's got this criminal history.
Okay. I thought it's Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that I'll direct to Mr. Nickel, but others could jump in if they had a view of it. Is the law enforcement data system, can it readily be filtered or sorted at a relatively minor expense or effort to screen out arrest data so that it's only the conviction data that you, at least some of you think is appropriate to be shared?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I'm not an expert on the technicalities of the LEDS screens, but I have some awareness of other screens that are created, and I don't think that's a terribly difficult technical problem to work out, but I'd defer to somebody from LEDS to give a more definitive answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll just tell you what I know, Representative Ackerman. We do various LEDS through the statutes, various LEDS access information at various points in different ways that I'm not sure that it's, again, money being no object, I don't think it's a big deal to just have convictions versus other data being displayed or available. So I don't think that's the problem. Obviously, they've got is if you gave everybody in every county a LEDS terminal, that's the cost that we're talking about. But they can restrict their access based on the way the system's designed.
Right, and it really the question is at what cost? Because money being no object,
right,
about many things can be done.
Right.
The question is it because there are easy filter or sort that would screen out that data.
It's just a question of the panel. I just want to make sure that I understand what your perception here is. We're in these processes. We're involved in a fact-finding process in which a circuit judge will ultimately make the decision regarding commitment or whether the person is a danger to himself or others. Do you view the authority which would be granted to you in this bill that is, to obtain this information, to mean that it's automatically admissible in court, or do you feel that it's just information that you can acquire and would have to go through objections by counsel for the alleged mentally ill person and discretion of the court before it be a part of the record?
I can answer that. Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman. The report itself, and after this bill, the LEDS report attached to the report is provided to all the parties. So the defense attorney, the actual allegedly mentally ill person, the state, who's represented by the district attorney's office, the judge, who's the fact finder, and then there are two mental health examiners, that everybody receives a copy of that report. And it, the report currently is separated into admissible portions and inadmissible portions. So they'll have a section that's entitled hearsay. And when the report is offered as evidence, we say we don't object, absent hearsay, so the hearsay is taken out. The judge has still read that, though, and it's always been our concern that the judge, being the fact finder, is hearing a lot of evidence that is not admissible, and it may not be part of the record. The LEDS report will be added to that information that the judge will read, know about, and then is supposed to not take into consideration when making their decision. It's very difficult to unring a bell once it's been rung, and so that's where the concern about the prejudicial nature is. A judge or a mental health professional looking at this information, it's very difficult for them to separate that out and not use it in the proceeding. But no, it would not be automatically admissible.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the panel? Representative Jensen.
Thank you. And probably several things. But quickly, this makes me nervous. As I understand it, the LEDS system, the LEDS report, is established for the purposes of helping police officers and others in the investigation of criminals or criminal behavior. Is that, am I off base on that?
It's a law enforcement tool.
And as I understand testimony today, we're saying that this law enforcement tool is not admissible in a court of law if a defendant reaches that point of going to court for trial. Is that also true?
Correct.
I'm getting question marks all over the place.
Can I address that?
Ms. Sky, why don't you address the question?
Chair Williams, Representative Jensen, the information or the report itself would never be admissible. Perhaps in some civil cases it might be admissible as a public record, but in a criminal or a proceeding such as a civil commitment proceeding, that report would never be admissible.
I'm not asking about a civil.
Okay.
I'm asking about a criminal court.
Right. In criminal, no. That report would never be admissible. The only exception to that would be if a defendant testifies, then some of the criminal convictions are admissible as impeachment to be used so that the state can argue, you can't believe this person because they've broken the law in this way. And those are only felony convictions or crimes of dishonesty, such as fraud, forgery, things like that would be admissible, only to argue that the person should not be considered a credible witness. So that those criminal convictions can never be argued by the state to suggest they were bad in the past, therefore they are bad now, which is precisely what they're being offered to be used here.
So as I understand it, we're proposing in this bill to introduce into the court a report that is generally except under some circumstances that you've just described, not admitted or admissible in a criminal court, which is the place that this information originally was intended for?
If I could, Ms. Scott, I think really what the bill does, and maybe you'll correct me if I get it wrong based on my reading of the bill, but what I think the bill does is it's really for making the probable cause determination by the, what do we call them, the crisis, what's the name
Chair of it? Chair Williams would be the investigator.
Okay, by the investigator, but making a probable cause determination, and that's in subsection C on page 3, Representative Jensen, of that section, for the purpose of making a probable cause determination under the subsection, a community mental health and developmental disabilities program director or a designee, which would be the investigator thereof, shall have access to the law enforcement data system. So they would have access to it for making the probable cause determination about whether or not to proceed with the proceeding for civil commitment. I think that's what the use is for, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. But the information, as I have heard the testimony here, once it's introduced, once it's used, becomes a part of the record. And it, as a part of the record, it goes before the court, because it is a judge that will be hearing this, and it's an adversarial, type of relationship where you have defense on one side and the county attorney, I believe, probably on the other side, arguing whether this person is to be committed or not committed. So in the case of a civil proceeding, then, we will have information in front of the judge that would generally not be in front of the judge in a criminal proceeding. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative. And just to be clear, it's technically not part of the record, and this is sort of the little fiction that is played out in a civil commitment proceeding. The report itself contains information that's not technically admissible, as well as LEDs would not be technically admissible, but it's sitting in written
is
form.
One of those, I withdraw that question.
Oh. But I just wanted to say all of that information is sitting
I'm
in
sorry,
written
Ms.
form in front of the judge while they're making their decision.
I think I understand, based on this, I have even a little more concern about this, that we are extending to the civil proceeding of commitments a little more than we do to the criminal area, and that, of course, would concern me. I have concerns about the use of this information for probable cause. I think I would suspect if the state or the whoever it is doesn't have a case without the LEDs, that their probable cause would be pretty weak. But that's and I do have some familiarity with mental health commitments and the commitment process, as such. So I'm going to leave it, I think, at that. There's a number of other issues that probably I would bring up a little bit later if necessary.
Jim, thank you, Representative. Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, kind of following up on what the chairman was talking about earlier with regards to the amount of information. Can access or can a LEDs report give an investigator insight for what type of treatment might be effective with a particular patient? I don't care. Any one of you can answer this. It's okay with me, Mr. Or
okay. Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, I guess, is the sole surviving mental health professional here. I'll try to take a shot at that.
Given our cuts, you might be the last one in the state.
That's what I'm beginning to be worried about. My understanding is that this information would be primarily used to assess the dangerousness aspect of the probable cause decision. It doesn't really play into, in my opinion, the degree to which the person has a mental illness or not is a separate issue that has to be proved and dealt with.
Mr. Chair, yes. I'm not an investigator, a county investigator. I can't speak for that, but my understanding of their position is that they're not in the business of trying to figure out how to treat this person. They're in the business of determining whether or not this person needs to go to court. That's their function. How to treat them is determined by staff at the hospital. Whether or not they're receiving that treatment, there are other aspects of the county mental health system that deal.
So it really is a safety evaluation issue. And again, I think the standard is safety of themselves or safety of others. That's sort of the talisman. Is that right?
Sure, that's correct.
Okay.
Should this be changed to allow access to LEDs for cause? In other words, if you have a person that is up before a judge on a civil commitment, and the police were called and the police showed up and he was standing in the door of his apartment brandishing a gun. I mean, there's obviously a potential danger to himself or others. Versus a person that, you know, is picked up at Riverfront Park because they're running through the park without any clothes on. They both may be mentally ill. They both may have a problem. The one running through Riverfront Park without any clothes on probably is not a danger to anybody, and it would not create a cause for needing to get a LEDS report. The one brandishing the gun, on the other hand, is a different situation. And potentially would be a cause for wanting or needing to get a report. It's just a thought. Thoughts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, just to comment on that is that years ago, I'm getting a little old here, but years ago I worked at the public defender and I did civil commitment representation, probably over 600 of them, if you can believe it. And during that time, I can tell you that any time there was any mention of a weapon existing within the facts around the case, that person was committed because you were dealing with the situation as it is right then. So in your hypothetical, the person brandishing the weapon, I don't know if this happened at Enterprise or in John Day or whatever, it might be considered differently, but certainly in the Portland area, any hint of a weapon is immediate civil commitment. The question more is if a person was picked up because they were experiencing a mental health crisis and it was learned that 5 years ago they had a weapons charge, and what relevance that would have to this particular situation. I think that's more likely the hypothetical. And I guess reasonable minds can differ as to whether that would make a difference or not. But if there was no immediate evidence that the person had a weapon or access to a weapon, I would suggest that it wouldn't be immediately relevant to the decision whether to place the person on a hold. So the civil commitment situation normally deals with the facts that exist right at the time. Why was the person picked up? Why were they brought in? Evidence can be elicited about that, and it can be used to make a decision, and that's appropriate.
Representative Sherlock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm probably more along the lines, I think, of what you said about this. It seems to me that just to say no under all circumstances, we're making the determination that it is not relevant in any circumstance and should not ever be considered under any circumstance by any investigator having to make this determination. I'm not sure that it is irrelevant in all circumstances. I think that's a determination that, you know, with proper training could best be made on a case-by-case basis as to what's relevant to the facts that bring the person in and what shows up on the record. Having said that, I do remember this debate from last session, and fiscal killed it then. It died of, right. of, of, of uh, a fiscal malaise last session, and it is most, it's probably dead if you look closely even now, before even it goes to Ways and Means in this session. So I suppose this is all academic.
It probably is. But that won't keep us from talking.
I'm trying to keep it fairly brief. having read a lot of LEDS reports over the years, having taken many people into the crisis centers, just off the top of my head, I would say, and I know everybody, or virtually everybody in the room would disagree, but I think actually the arrest is more indicative of past activity. However, I don't think it should be used here, and I don't think the LEDS reports are really that appropriate to this. The high costs are going to prevent it here. And I also have some real grave concerns about having too many LEDS terminals out and about. Just kind of a personal observation on, I don't know who should all be seeing those. And I know you restrict who can turn them on, but there's a lot of information there that I'm concerned about. LEDS reports are hard to read and hard to explain. I would think they'd be very difficult to explain to somebody who was really mentally ill, too. So I think the idea is good. I think what everybody wants, including the people who are opposed to this, is to get the best care they can for somebody who's who's mentally ill, who needs help. But I sure don't think this is the way to go on this one.
Well, we're going to stop with this panel. Appreciate it very much. We still have two more witnesses, Phil Chadsey and Francis Baker from NAMI. If both of you would come up. You've now heard the committee ruminate on the subject for some time. So with that in mind, you can tell us right what you think.
I'll let Frances go first, because I think she was the chairman of the group that drafted the original bill.
Right.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Frances Baker. I was the chairman of the work group that put together the legislation for the last session. We were part of the joint committee. Joint House and Senate Committee on Mentally Ill Persons and Mental Health Treatment. And as Mr. Junef pointed out, this originally came before the committee in two different bills the last time. And that's why I was a little unclear when I said I'm for the bill, but I'm for part of the bill. The bill that the work group recommended the last time would have allowed access to LEDs for the investigator only, and would have allowed him to include pertinent convictions in his report to the court. It would not have allowed arrest. And another part of this bill that I don't think the distinction was made during the previous discussion, this gives access to LEDs at two different stages of the process. This bill gives access to the initial person who first sees the mentally ill person and has to make an initial, immediate decision: am I going to hold this person long enough to do an investigation on them and decide if they need to go to court? Once that decision's made and the person's in custody, then an investigator is appointed, and then the investigator does the investigation and submits the report to the court to determine if the person will actually be committed. The work group did not feel that the initial decision maker, who is oftentimes in an emergency room trying to make this kind of a decision, should have access to the LEDs information, because the LEDs report can be very confusing and can be very misleading and can contain any number of arrests that never led to conviction. So we felt that the only person who should have access to the LEDs information was the investigator, who would have time to get the report, sift through it, look at the information, and perhaps use the information about arrest to go talk to the people who were involved in the incident and get some background information, so that they would have all that available when they make their report to the court, but the court would only know about pertinent convictions. Also, I didn't see it in this bill. I know it certainly wasn't part of the work group's idea that the LEDs report would be attached to the investigative report. That was never anticipated. It would simply be something the investigator could look at, but it would not be a part of the record, and it would not be attached to the investigative report. So I'm here to support the bill in a limited version where the investigator would have access to LEDs and would be allowed to inform the court about pertinent convictions.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Francis. Bill?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I guess I'm probably the guilty one because when I came down here and testified, I think in September, about which bills should be pre-introduced or not, at that time we had a number of bills in front of us, and one of them was the original bill and one of them was the amended bill. And between myself and then Bill Taylor, we got confused as which bill. But I agree with Francis that the original bill is the one that we've always supported, and that was one that only calls for conviction and only information to the investigator. And the reason it's important for the investigator to have convictions is so that he can go out and interview people and make a determination of whether or not those people should actually be called as witnesses at the civil commitment hearing. And that's the reason the information is important, not that the information or the report goes to the court at all.
Okay. Are there questions? Representative Jensen.
Yes, a question for Francis. In your proposal, or you understood what you wanted to have come before the committee, where only the investigator would have the report, would that information be made available? And is there any provision in the legislation that you're proposing, or that we have here, that would ensure that whoever was representing that person in front of the court would have access to the same information?
It's not provided for in the bill as it is.
Would that not be important?
It could be. I mean, the LEDS report could be made a part of the investigative report and could be submitted to the party that was under the commitment.
Are there further questions for either Mr. Chasty or Ms. Baker? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2082. And that completes our work for the afternoon, committee members. I appreciate you sticking it out for your involvement in the discussion and bills today. We're adjourned.